what is it? Her, it's Beyonce. It's like yeah, you know this song. Hit 'em up style. That's what it's called.
Okay.
You know this song.
Never heard it.
Yes, you have. Yes, you have. Welcome to The Geek in Review, the podcast focused on innovative and creative ideas in the legal industry. I'm Marlene Gebauer.
And I'm Greg Lambert. This week we sat down and talked with Noah Weisberg and Dr. Alexander Hudek of Kira Systems about their upcoming book, AI for Lawyers, How Artificial Intelligence is Adding Value, Amplifying Expertise, and Transforming Careers. So the book gets released on February 3rd, and Noah and Alex give us some insights on what they're covering in the book and why they wrote the book in the way that they did.
So stick around for that, but now let's get to this week's Information Inspirations. So I want to give a quick shout out to SKILLS, which stands for Strategic Knowledge and Innovative Legal Leaders Summit. Hey, Greg, that's us.
Yeah, that's us.
So normally we have this meeting right after Legal Week in New York, but, well, pandemic, so we took it online. We used a platform called Shindig, which worked really well. Speakers were on the podium presenting, and the audience could have video or normal chat sessions during networking time. And I got to tell you, I mean, it was kind of fun to chase people's pictures on the screen and jump into the conversations. So the content was excellent as usual, and we had a number of new faces and speakers this year talking about all things KM. And what was really nice is that the second day was broadcast to the public on YouTube, and I hope that continues.
Yeah, I actually was able to sit in and watch a few sessions.
And our good friends Ryan McLeod of Sente Advisors and Nicole Braddock of Theory and Principle won for their new product, Map Engine, which automatically creates maps from all your 50-state surveys. Greg, you and I had a sneak peek before the conference, and it seems very easy to use and super useful.
Yeah, it was. In fact, I was listening to a podcast that was talking about child seat safety across all 50 states, and the first thing I thought of is, ooh, I could use the map engine for this.
I have to say, Nicole and Ryan sounded a lot like you and me on the pod. You know, they even had outtakes. So, you know, I think we need a cut of the prize.
I'll talk with both of them, see what we can
All right, let's make that happen.
So, Marlene, our friend and early podcast guest, Jay just put out a 5-part blog post series on the Legal Evolution blog where she discusses the hashtag great expectations for the hashtag great reset for the post-pandemic legal market. And you know Jay's style, so the writing is full of emojis and graphics, and you know it's a bit lengthy.
I have them saved. I have the part saved to read, and I'm gonna like do it on a Sunday.
Yeah. So the final post came out at the end of last week. So for those of you waiting to sit down and read the whole series in one sitting, now's your chance. Jay's run of the timeline from revisiting the Great Recession and how the legal industry woke up to the tensions between the buyers and sellers of legal services, she covers that in part one, and in part two through four, she shifts over to who will be the winners and losers in a post-pandemic legal economy. And then finally, the last of the series covers trends to watch out for the next 5 years. And of course, legal technology and innovations are factors, but you know, it can be a bit tricky. And so she wraps up the series with a variation of Forrest Gump's mama's saying of stupid is as stupid does by saying, like Jay said, that innovation is as innovation does. And she states, and I wanted to quote this, and in some ways, technology is both the driving force and the great red herring of our time. Organizational transformation of any flavor is a human endeavor. No matter the external pressures or intrinsic rewards, meaningful change doesn't just happen. Persistent people and committed teams make them happen. So it's a really good series, so I suggest people go out and read them. One of the things that really made me happy was as I was reading through the series, a lot of people that she mentions and companies that she mentions have been on this show. So it kind of validates what we're trying to do here with innovation and creativity in the legal space.
That's great. Yeah. We've discussed the bar exam during pandemic many times on the show and how it seemed the approach was very haphazard, yeah. To put it mildly.
Yeah, just mildly.
Well, now we have some stats to back us up. The collaboratory, did you even know that was a word? I did not know that was a word.
All right.
On legal education and licensing for the practice reports that the July 2020 bar exam resembled a harsh game of musical chairs. Yeah. Jurisdictions postponed the test, limited seats, switched formats, and announced last-minute changes. Candidates struggled just to stay in the game. The collaboratory also reports that the number of qualified applicants went down from 46,000 approximately last year to approximately 38,000 this year. The collaboratory finds that for candidates with resources to wait, the delay paid off. Pass rates rose in many jurisdictions. In New York, the overall pass rate rocketed to 84% on the October exam, which was administered online, compared to just 65% on the July 2019 exam. But for candidates who lacked those resources, the pass rate was zero. That's the dark side of this year's summer-fall bar exam. More than 8,000 qualified candidates never took the exam. And women, people of color, and people with disabilities were the most likely to be deterred by the burdens of the exam. Just another reminder that reform is needed for licensing.
Well, Marlene, my second inspiration, I usually don't recommend CLE presentations, but I'm going to make an exception for one that's coming up on February 2nd that's being put on by the University of Texas Law School in order to launch the Ginsburg Initiative at UT's Center for Women in the Law. The panelists are just amazing. But the moderator is someone that everyone should know, and that's Nina Totenberg, who is NPR's legal affairs correspondent.
Boom!
Yeah, yeah. But the panelists, the speakers include four former Ruth Bader Ginsburg clerks. And, what can be better than this type of content, the moderator and the speakers? And if that's not enough, it's free. And on top of that, if you're in Texas or a reciprocal state, you also get 1.25 hours of CLE credit. So it's a win-win-win-win situation. Well, that wraps up this week's Information Inspirations.
While some of you may know Noah Weisberg through his work with Kira Systems, some of us also know him through his children's book, Robbie the Robot Learns to Read.
I have a signed copy myself.
Yes, we both do. He and his colleague, Dr. Alexander Hudak, have decided to write a new book on AI, but this time it's focused on a more mature audience in the legal field.
We'd like to welcome Noah Weisberg back to the show, along with Dr. Alexander Hudak, to discuss their upcoming book, AI for Lawyers, How Artificial Intelligence is Adding Value, Amplifying Expertise, and Transforming Careers, which gets released on February 3rd. Noah and Alex, welcome to the Geek in Review.
Awesome to be back. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
I suppose that books like these are inevitable when you put a lawyer and a PhD in computer science together and they start talking about what is possible in the legal field if you add the potential of artificial intelligence. So, Alex, give us a bit of the backstory of how you decided to write this book and why does this book need to exist?
Noah and I have been selling legal technology and AI in particular to law firms now for many years. One of the biggest hindrances to adoption is really just understanding what AI is, how it can affect people, how do you use it, and how it can change business. There's often a lot of fear around it because of misunderstanding. And so we felt that writing this book would be the best way for us to conquer some of those fears for people and really just give them the insights they need to really understand it, apply it, and cut through the various hype and misinformation that's being thrown around AI.
So I don't know that it's inevitable that we wrote a book at all. We've got one book under our belts, Robbie the Robot Learns to Read, our very nice children's book on machine learning. I think the main project for us with a lawyer and a comp sci PhD has just been building care systems, which we've done over the past decade. And a majority of the world's largest law firms use our tech to do contract review work. The book came to us, as Alex says, for a sort of specific problem that we were trying to solve, which is that there's a lot of information out there on the what of legal AI, right? Like there is this company doing this and this company doing that, and there are good bloggers and journalists covering the legal AI space now. But there's a deeper problem, which is getting lawyers, like whether that's lawyers in large firms, lawyers in small firms, in-house lawyers, getting them to actually care that this is going on and having them understand like why this is important to them. So this book is, there's lots of sites and information on the details of legal AI, if you feel like it. What we really tried to do is make a case for why lawyers should know that it exists and why they should care and why they should embrace or ignore it.
So before we talk about what's actually in the book, I want to back up and take a 30,000 foot look at just what we're talking about when we say artificial intelligence when it comes to the scope of what the legal industry needs. So Alex, what makes something authentically an AI product or a process?
Wow. So that is a loaded question.
Yes, it is.
So people have been arguing about what authentic AI is for, decades, right? Way back when in the early days of computing, it was, people were like, oh, hey, look, a computer can play chess. That is clearly an intelligent task. This is AI.
Right.
Whereas now today, people snob that off and be like, well, it's just like, computing stuff in advance. It's not really smart, right? And so that there's this trend of moving goalposts that, things become, when a technology becomes normal, suddenly it becomes not AI, it just becomes planning.
It's no longer magical. Right? It's just a process.
Yeah.
And
today is like even more challenging around AI because it's again a hyped up thing. People call all sorts of things AI. There are some products even out there that have a mix of computers and actual people behind the scenes doing things, and they bill themselves as AI too. So it can be really, really difficult to navigate what things are really AI and what things are not. In the book, we don't try and answer that question definitively. Rather, what we do is we define what it means to us. And what it means to us is really technology that does, human-like reasoning or intelligent tasks. And that could be something like machine learning or deep learning, which is what you see dominating the world. Or it could be something like rule-based systems. Expert systems, for example, were very, very popular in the past, and they're still used today, although they're not as hyped as much. So all of those things to us can be AI, and we try not to draw a hard line. Definitely, though, if you have humans doing it, that's not AI.
So, Noah, in the book, you say AI is an actual modern job creator. How does that work, and will there be winners and losers as AI becomes more integrated into our processes?
We say AI is a modern job creator because one of the fundamental things going on that we see in law right now is that there's way more work to be done than is being done. There's this massive sort of latent demand for legal services that's not getting answered. And you see that certainly on the access to justice side, right, where there's tons of people who can't get representation who need it. But you see it in middle class people too. Like, I wonder if the Geek and Review podcast has great sort of lawyer negotiated contracts, or if you just kind of winged it with stuff like that. And then going a step above that, even like the biggest companies in the world, like a JP Morgan or a GM or a Tesla, still have tons of things they don't know about their legal situation and don't bother to track because it's just too expensive, too time consuming, too difficult to solve. And there's this massive opportunity in solving these problems for these people who have legal needs that aren't being met. And what AI can do, one way that it can be a modern job creator, is it can just allow us to solve problems that we would never solve without AI. Now, you ask, is this sort of like going to be flatly applied across the profession, right? Is everyone going to benefit from this? And the answer is no. Like, there are going to be people who take advantage of this technology enhancement and are taking advantage right now of this technology enhancement. And it's allowing them to serve their clients better, to do sort of higher quality work, faster work, but not even that, like also do things that their non-AI supported competitors can't. And those people, I think it seems pretty reasonable to think that they're probably going to win. People who are just doing things the same old way, it's hard to see how that plays out super well for them. And I think one kind of misconception is that you can just sort of buy a piece of software and then like you'll catch up immediately. But I don't think that's necessarily the case. Like Marlene, as you know very well, it takes a lot of effort to just learn and to get your people trained and to get people thinking about doing work differently. Like that's a multi-year process. And if you're doing it, you better get started right away. Like to me, an analogy that I always think about is I used to practice law at Weil Gotshal. And Weil had one of the premier private equity practices and the premier bankruptcy practice. And basically the reason it had that, like Weil had smart lawyers, but like so did lots of other firms. The reason it was so good in those two practice areas is it got there earlier, right? Like it was just there first. Like even as I think about Skadden and Wachtell, like obviously populated by super smart lawyers, but like they were not that big of a deal pre the M&A boom of the 80s. But like, again, they just got there first and spent more time. And I think it's reasonable to think that AI is going to be the same kind of thing. Like you spend more time thinking about how this can impact your practice, training your people on it, just seeping them in it, making them think about what's possible with it. It's going to accrue to your benefit.
You mentioned one thing in the book that really caught my attention. And I have to be honest, I hadn't heard of it before. I think it was like Javan's paradox or something like that.
Javan's paradox.
Javan's paradox. But, you know, basically, I'm just remembering off the top of my head here, but basically it's driving additional demand by making, you know, giving more opportunities for a certain service. And and just by happenstance this morning, I was on my Twitter account and there was a bankruptcy startup, online bankruptcy startup, and they were getting into a fight with some bankruptcy attorneys saying that they were stealing their work, you know, and he was like, look, these people can't afford a bankruptcy attorney. So it's either us or they don't file for bankruptcy. And so we're creating an opportunity here. So I think that's a rough example of what I think you can do by expanding the base of people that you can provide a service to.
I think, so I got two sort of responses. Number one, like if the work can be automated, lawyers are supposed to be working in their client's best interests. And like the protection of bankruptcy lawyer incomes or something like that. Like, I think it's hard to say that that's like a really legit consideration. Like you're certainly not serving people. If you think it can be done as well by software and technology can do it, then like, great, like that should happen. Cause there's lots of other work for bankruptcy attorneys. Like perhaps the bankruptcy wave hasn't materialized as heavily as some thought it might with the pandemic, but like I would have to imagine that there is work these days available for bankruptcy lawyers. But Javan's paradox, which you point to, is a super interesting concept, right? So the idea of it, it came from the first industrial revolution. And the idea was that there were these innovations made that made the use of coal more efficient. And what this William Stanley Javans noted was that you'd think if an innovation makes the use of coal more efficient, that you'd use less coal. But what he saw paradoxically was the more efficient technology got at harnessing the energy out of coal, the more coal people used. And that was sort of paradoxical, hence the Javan's paradox, right? So you see lots of examples of this. Like one example that we point to in the book is the Ford Motor Company, right? So Ford got more and more efficient in building cars through use of the assembly line, right? And you'd think that that would mean that like greater efficiency means less factory workers, And that's not exactly how it played out in the auto sector. It became much more efficient at building cars, which meant that many more people could get cars. They sort of brought them to a level of affordability that more people could afford them. And that meant way more auto worker jobs. And I think when people have historically been, like I've been on ILTA panels and the like for years, and, you know, I remember back in like 2014, 2015, it was like, you know, let's fast forward to 2024. There are going to be more or less lawyers with AI. And everybody was like, there's definitely going to be less. Like AI reduces the amount of labor that goes into people. And the seeds for the book were really our thinking back then that, like, no, that's not necessarily the case. Like, as people get more efficient at doing work, that creates opportunity to actually sell more of that work to people who wouldn't buy it when it was more expensive, when it was more slow. So that's how we see Siobhan's paradox playing out in legal. Like, just this greater efficiency, it's not a given that it means less lawyer work. And in fact, we think it's very possible it means more lawyer work.
You have a chapter written by some of our friends in your book, friends of ours over at Case Tech, such as I think it's Jake Heller, Laura Safdie, and Pablo Arredondo. They wrote a chapter on legal research and AI. So Noah, what has your research for pulling this book together taught you about the current state of AI and legal research and where you think it might take us?
Just stepping back, the reason that we pulled Jake, Laura, and Pablo into the book is Alex and I know sort of a few things super, super well. Number one, we know contract analysis software really well. Like, we were some of the first people in the AI part of that industry, and like, we've been doing it for a long time, and our software is pretty heavily used for that. And like, it's the consensus software used by most big firms in the world. So we know that area super well. So like, when it came to writing a chapter about contract analysis, like, Alex and I felt pretty good. We also know kind of and have thought a lot about making the case for AI, right? The thing that I was talking about before about why lawyers should even care that AI exists and how it might impact their practice. We know that case really well. And over the years, we've heard lots of reasons that lawyers are nervous about AI, sort of objections that they have and fears that they have. So those are things that we felt super well qualified to write on. But when it came to things like e-discovery or legal research or expert systems or even small law firms or legal prediction, like, those are things where we knew there were other people that knew them so much better. And happily, from sort of having been in the community for a really long time, we knew who smart people were on the topic. And the Case Tech crew definitely stands out to us as super sharp. And so it was great to get them involved in the project. I think the legal research space is super interesting right now. In terms of AI, like, you have Thomson Reuters and others have been putting AI into their legal research products in various forms for like decades, and don't necessarily get credit for that. But over the last few years, especially Case Tech, but also I think we saw other efforts with like Ravel and Judicata of people really trying to bring something new and really pushing the world forward there. And I think it also appears that like Lexis and others have put a lot of effort into kind of keeping up and, you know, even surpassing where they can. I would have a hard time saying like what the exact future is going to be, but I think the overall concept is that with legal research, you've got people spending vast amounts of time trying to find little needles that are super important to a given case. And what the AI is going to do is get even closer and closer to finding the right precedent at the right time. The other thing that I find super fascinating about legal research is all the stuff like Case Text has done with thinking about like whether someone should have to enter a search to find appropriate precedent, or whether it might be better to just put in your brief or your opponent's brief and have the software think about what's appropriate there and maybe even start drafting a response. And I think that's super cool and really just thinking an example of them and others thinking really deeply about their users and what the problems are they face in dealing with case law.
What do you say to lawyers or legal professionals who oversee AI implementation within the legal space and who agree that the practice of law is messy and inefficient, but that AI is complicated, difficult to implement, and so they'd rather deal with the devil they know? And maybe, Alex, this is one for you.
Yeah, sure. I would say it depends entirely on the vendor and the solution. Some AI solutions absolutely are complicated to implement, but that's true of a lot of software, right? There's certain softwares out there, in finance and ERP software that is fantastically challenging to implement. But that's not true of every software and every vendor. And AI can be easy to implement. There are plenty of vendors that have very straightforward and easy to install software packages. The harder challenge is actually around changing the way you do your work internally in a law firm. Just, imagine something like Slack. If you've never used instant messaging, you're used to using the phone all the time and you're implementing Slack. I mean, Slack's not complicated. It's really simple. But changing the habits and the process within a company, that does take some time. That is true of AI and other technologies. When we talk to law firms, we do a lot to try and help them understand, how to change their practice to adopt AI and do provide them a level of guidance around that. And we find that's quite important to the firms in helping them adopt. But it is definitely not the case that AI has to be confusing and challenging and difficult to implement.
Yeah, it's interesting you talk about change management, and I'm glad to hear that you are offering guidance to your customers in terms of how to change the practice in order to make the adoption more smooth. Because a lot of times what happens is people are busy with their work. It's not that they don't think it's important, but I guess they don't see it as part of their role now in addition to practicing law is really, keeping on top of these things and being present to try these things out and give opinions on them. And I know that's sort of the bane of lots of vendors because they just can't get the feedback. They just can't get people to pay attention because, people don't think or feel that is their role. So what types of guidance are you offering or would you recommend offering?
Well, the first thing is just this book, right? Like what we're trying to do with this book really is...
Of course.
No, like I'm serious actually. The way that... one thing that we found over the years is that if you get actual partners engaged and like intellectually engaged with, like if they have a desire to do this and like they think this is the way things should be done at their firm, it goes a lot smoother, right? Like if they actually care. And so what we tried to do with this book is just explain it to them in a way that's like super readable and understandable about why they should care and why this is good for them. So I think that's like the first part. If you can engage lawyers like partners, associates, clients, and make them just sort of ask about this and think about this and ask why aren't we doing this better, I think that's the first and most important step. Like if they desire to get to the destination, they're a lot more likely to get to the destination. Second thing that we can do is we can help share stories about what we've seen work. Like what we've seen work at different firms, what we've seen work within a firm. Like maybe we know that Michelle in the private equity group has had a bunch of projects that have gone really successfully using AI, and we can try to spread Michelle's story to others in that firm. Or maybe we can say to a firm like, you guys aren't doing so well, but your big competitor across town, like they're leading the way. And thankfully, because we have a good enough client base, we actually have like pretty good insight into that. And one of the quirks that I think both you two would know about the legal space is though these firms are like highly competitive with each other in some ways, they're highly collaborative around technology adoption, like which we see with ILTA and the like. Right, that a lot of the times the firms really all would like to implement best practice and the administrators often work really, really, really well together. And so we can take learnings from one firm and help share it to another firm and even connect people at the different firms so that they can learn from other people with relevant experience. So I think that's the second part. And then there's other things that we're trying to do a lot more of now, like just create on-demand video training that's like, you know, a 2-minute video on how do you do this or how do you do that, and lots more in-app communications and the like, and more automated ways of getting people that information. So I think those are three things. Like, number one, just getting the senior and all the lawyers on it to understand the why of why you'd care about changing. Number two, taking the learnings from within a place and sharing it to others within that place and to other places that are trying to have success. So just sort of raising the benchmark of what's possible. And then number three, just trying to do automated methods to just help spread understanding of how to do work. Lots more too.
I imagine it's always changing, you know, in terms of
how hopefully it's not changing too much, because we do try to standardize stuff where we can. I would say it's a constant battle, right? You can always do better. But I actually, like, I say that, but then there's tons of examples of great success of technology adoption with lawyers, right? Like, we give lawyers tons of grief over their technology adoption. But in fact, like, you think about how ubiquitous electronic legal research is, or virtual data rooms are, or redlining software is. And like, none of those were at one point in time, right? Like, they were the exception, and then they were sometimes used, sometimes not. And now they're ubiquitous. I think the same is going to happen with some of these AI technologies, and is already on the way there with things like e-discovery and contract analysis.
Well, Noah, when I thought of this question, I thought it was outside the box, but I think it actually expands a little bit on your second point of what you just answered. For anyone who has sold products to a law firm or practically any legal services, that they know that the sales cycle in these firms and in other legal services is extremely long and extremely slow. Firms don't just tend to jump in immediately and try new things out. And I imagine this is especially true with products that they say, you know, uses artificial intelligence in order to make their products superior to the other products on the market. So how are you seeing successful companies overcome this obstacle of getting law firms and others to buy and actually use the products?
Well, it's like the adoption question is just a constant battle and a search to do things better. In the early days, we did extensive proof of concepts, right? Where we would go to a firm and tell them, this can make you a lot better at doing this work. And the firm would say, I don't know if we can do better, but maybe we'll try it. And so they would run a proof of concept, and they would do that in different ways. Like, sometimes they might have one group doing the project using the software and another group doing the project the traditional way. Another time they might just have a group, after doing a transaction, have another group go back and try to do the transaction again. Using the software can be kind of dangerous to do that, because sometimes you find stuff with the software that you should have found with the humans. So that can be a really good way to see the value of AI, but also raises some risks. Or the third way you'd see people doing proof of concepts is they would just try the software on a matter or two and just anecdotally see how people liked it. Today, we, like, for at least Kira Systems, a place where a majority of, you know, most competitors of a firm are using the software already, we don't necessarily have to do that as much. There's still some firms that might feel like doing proof of concept, but I think more often you're really trying to show that they get value out of the software. So the sales cycle has shifted a little. Sorry for the background noise as well. It's Toronto is in full-on lockdown, so we've got a bunch of youth in the house running around.
Yeah, luckily my college students are crying in their dorm.
that is good. Ours are definitely bouncing off the walls without playing with their friends. So I think you're always just trying to get people to go faster. But I think, you know, as when we were talking about adoption, like, the most important part in the adoption story, as well as the buying story, is getting lawyers to actually desire being more efficient and, like, understanding that this AI technology can help them run a better law practice. And we find, like, if you can solve that problem, the rest of the problems tend to go a lot easier. And like things can speed up a bunch.
What has the pandemic done to either amplify or mute the impact of AI in the legal industry?
Well, a bit of both, probably. I think the pandemic, there's definitely people using digital tools in ways that they might not have pre-pandemic. And so the AI tools are digital tools, so they get included in that. But I think there's lots of non-AI tools that have also been lifted by that. The other thing it's done is it's raised some problems that AI tools can help solve. Like, for example, early in the pandemic, if you were trying to figure out the implications of force majeure or termination of convenience or the like, AI was a really quick way to help people do that work that needed to be done really quickly. So there was definite use case around that. On the other hand, adoption is always just adoption, and getting people to use it is always a hard battle. And one of the really nice things about having people sort of in office is you could get someone who was like, you know, on the 31st floor of their office building, they could go and talk to their neighbors and kind of like jawbone them into using technology. Like you might have the knowledge management or innovation people might be more likely to hear that someone was working on a project just through the grapevine and be able to tell them about using AI. And I think that anecdotally, my sense is that's not happening as much. So, you know, there's good and bad about the pandemic for pushing AI. Ultimately, I think client pressure for efficiency really helps the adoption of efficiency technology. And I think the pandemic is sort of pushing clients and pushing their budgets, which is going to push them to get their lawyers to be more efficient, which should yield more business for AI companies. But I would say it's been mixed in terms of what we've seen. Like there's definitely a lot of firms also where people are just strained. Like they have a lot going on, and you know, in a lot of IT departments, there's been a lot of time spent just on like keeping the lights, like the virtual lights on. And so they've had to put a lot of effort into that and take it away from thinking about ways to do things better.
I wonder if the people are realizing that perhaps they are more flexible in terms of learning these things quickly than perhaps they thought they were beforehand, just, you know, because they had to do it out of necessity. So I'm wondering if that's one of the changes too.
Yeah, I think it definitely could. Like, I'm sure there are people who, you know, used to dictate everything or handwrite everything to their assistant and like, or physically talk to people. And they realized that like this video conferencing stuff isn't too hard. Like it's actually pretty easy to look at files online as opposed to getting someone to print them out for you. Like, I think that has happened. I think this will help long term, but it's not like video conferencing software or something like that, where it's like clearly way up.
Well, Alex, if you could pull out your crystal ball and look into the future, what do you see when it comes to when there's a time when AI is no longer a novelty that we discuss on podcasts like this and is simply part of everyday life for the lawyer or the legal professional?
Yeah, I mean, so in many ways, actually, you can see what the future will look like by reflecting on today. The problem with a term like AI is that it's so broad. And the reality is that you need to think more about specific domains. You know, for example, voice recognition. This is arguably solidly under the AI camp. It's certainly under the machine learning camp. And there was a time where, you know, the idea that a computer could understand human voice was like mind-blowing, right? Everyone today takes it absolutely for granted. However, we're still talking about AI just in different things, in areas where AI previously couldn't do anything or wasn't accurate enough to make a big impact. Now you're seeing those new things or where it is being able to make an impact, like in law and you know, document review. And so we're talking about those. And very likely in the future, when that becomes normal, there'll be some other task in some other domain where it's like, wow, now suddenly we have these capabilities where it can do things that we didn't think it would be able to do. And we'll be end up talking about those. So I do think we'll end up talking about AI for a long time to come. However, in any given domain, yeah, eventually it'll become boring. Like how many people talk about Siri versus Google Assistant now? you know, just a few years ago, that was a big deal. Now everyone's like, yeah, of course I can ask my computer what, you know, the weather is, and it's no big deal.
Alex and I went out for dinner and we like literally told his car, this pre-pandemic, literally told his car, you know, where we felt like going, and then it drove us part of the way there. And it felt like surprisingly normal.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Very interesting. Well, Noah Weisberg and Dr. Alexander Hudek, thanks for taking the time to talk with us. You have a book coming out on February 3rd called AI for Lawyers, How Artificial Intelligence is Adding Value, Amplifying Expertise, and Transforming Careers. Where can we locate that book once it's out?
Your favorite bookseller. I know Amazon's got a heap of copies. But it's been published by Wiley, who's like a major publisher. And one of the reasons that we did that, like we self-published Robbie the Robot Learns to Read, our really excellent children's book on machine learning.
It is. I can vouch for that.
I have a signed copy.
Me too.
Totally. So having done that, we realized that, you know, it was actually a pretty good book, and we could have gotten so much more pickup of it if we'd used a real publisher, we thought. So with this one, we really felt like going with a big publisher. So because Wiley's the publisher, you should be able to get it like anywhere. Like, I don't know if it'll be on the airport bookshelves these days, but that's the kind of thing that Wiley does.
Excellent.
All right. Well, Noah and Alex, thanks for talking with
us. Thank you.
It's been fun.
Yeah, thanks for having us. This was fun. It's good to see you guys.
Well, Marlene, it was nice catching up with Noah and Alex and to talk about their new AI for Lawyers book. You know, it sounds like Noah is having the same situation that many of us are having to go through with trying to take care of work and home and children all at the same time.
You know, I just feel good that it wasn't me this time.
Yeah.
Between the dog and the kids, you know, sort of running through and talking to me. So, you know, it was a relief to know that other people also have these issues.
Yeah. So thanks again to Noah Weisberg and Dr. Alexander Hudek for joining us. Again, we have links for their AI for Lawyers book in the show notes. And like Marlene said, the book comes out on February 3rd, so pre-orders are available.
Before we go, we want to remind listeners to take the time to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Rate and review us as well. If you have comments about today's show or suggestions for a future show, you can reach us on Twitter at GayBauerM or at Glambert, or you can call the Geek & Review hotline at 713-487-7270, or email us at geekandreviewpodcast@gmail.com. And as always, the music you hear is from Jerry David DeSica. Thank you, Jerry.
Thanks, Jerry. All right, Marlene, I will talk to you later.
Okay, bye-bye.
Devil's Backbone Ball.